Welcome to The Business Show. We believe that our journey through this world is one we must take together, expanding, learning, and growing as a united force. We know that history is being made right now, and the decisions we make today will shape our tomorrow. These decisions will not only impact us, but will define the future for generations to come. If we don't make the right choices now, we risk creating a future we don't want. That's why we're here, to slay the dragons of the modern world and to face the challenges it brings head on. The future demands that we come together to tackle these challenges, and the only way forward is through unity and collaboration. Let's rise together, undivided but united.
Today, we're diving into some incredibly relevant topics for leaders today. Cultural intelligence, the balance between AI and human requirements. These areas are critical for shaping the leaders of tomorrow and navigating a complex globalized business landscape. I would like to welcome a friend, an ally, and a sponsor, Dean and Director of Henley Business School, John Foster Pedley. Hello!
Hi, Carmen. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's so awesome. Every time when you and I have discussions, I'm like, oh my gosh, my world is about to be changed. So, John, before we even get started, 2025 is around the corner. Corporates are always looking at where is the goals of the business schools, because you play a pivotal role into where business direction goes. Where do you see 2025 going, and where will your focus be for next year?
We've got so many elections happening this year worldwide. We've got such change in South Africa. We've got a shift from being a lot of pessimism, you know, with electricity going off and worrying about the government. So we're looking at a more positive hope for South Africa, a better mood. And I think that's reflecting on what you see going on in business generally. But there are so many imponderables. I think what I see for 2025 is that we're going to have to deal with increasing amount of uncertainty and complexity. Nobody wants to hear that, but I think it's true. Mm. We've got a cascading issue with climate and environment that's not going away. So I think what we're going to have to do is just think, wow, how are we going to A, stay sane, and B, do something about that in a very difficult world while we're trying to keep our businesses running, keeping people employed, providing value to customers, and also making enough money to keep everything afloat. Because, you know, we're not obsessed with profit, but you need to have profit in order to reinvest in a business, give back to your shareholders, and to innovate and to continually improve. So I think we're facing another very interesting year. Everyone would like to think there are three things to remember for 2025. So let me come up with three. Well, complexity, understand that, you know, being centered, another C, stay centered. And be concerned about what's going on. Mm. And fundamentally, CCCD, you know, maintain disciplines. You know, you're going to get a lot further by being disciplined in what you do. And we all know how hard that is. It's all very good me talking about discipline. I know I can be very undisciplined sometimes in some areas and disciplined in others. But we have to have a discipline and a commitment to just carrying on through all this. What we can't do is give up hope. Mm. On the contrary, you've got to stay positive. Mm. You know.
Yeah, and also, I love what you're saying regarding bringing hope, because obviously it gets the dopamine levels and it actually improves the critical thinking elements, right? There was a research study that I was reading about joint up thinking, and where if people are actually in a good mood when they do brainstorming together, they're actually aligned and they actually solve problems better. Whereas if there's a lot of stress and anxiety around trying to brainstorm and innovation and solving problems, usually your teams are not aligned on solving that problem and looking at innovative ways to solve that problem. So it's definitely necessary in order to bring the balance of a very chaotic world and aligning it with a little bit more streamlined happiness, dopamine, right?
Mm. Well, I think one of the things is that we need to be sufficiently anxious, but not too little, not too much. And it's like one of those bell curves, you know, like if you're sufficiently aware, consciously heard is very interesting. To stay conscious, you need to be alert. You need to be situationally aware. You can't be half asleep and you can't be falling apart out of panic and, you know, just whole of you is just dissipating because you can't cope with anything. So somehow you've got to keep in that sweet spot, which is neither apathetic and nor is it neurotic. Mm. And so in ourselves and the people around ourselves, you've got to be aware of what's going on. The thing is to make reality your friend, not your enemy. Mm-hmm. And reality is a tough thing to understand. I mean, by avoiding reality, you can live in a bubble, and that's fine as long as your bubble accidentally perhaps is somewhere near where reality is. But you can't change the world around you. So you've got to work out how you manage it. Mm-hmm. And if you're despairing or neurotic about that, you're never going to be able to cope. So how do we center? How do we stay calm? How do we look at the situation around? How do we stay with some balance? I mean, always remember that for everything that's disastrous that's going on, and all these crazies that are doing that, there are hundreds of people who are not doing that. There's a sort of force field in the middle, which is like holding everything in stasis. If we all gave up, then all the craziness would happen, wouldn't it? Mm-hmm. So there's an awful lot of people fighting and holding that there. We tend to obsess on all the things that are going wrong and not notice so many things around you and all these little actions we're all doing, trying to hold it in some sort of saner, better world. And I think we need to rather focus on those a bit more for your own sanity and realize that we're all working together in ways that we tend to undervalue. Mm. We tend to overvalue the chaos because it's threatening. But let's think a little bit more about what we're all doing to hold it in place. And if we work better together, we'll move it in the right direction. And that goes back to your idea of teamwork. You know, if you're neurotic, you're going to be anxious and you're probably going to be competitive because you think, wow, I haven't got any resources. I need to fight, grab from the other person. And often when I'm opening a class, I'll say to a class, you know, when you send your kids to school, if you've got kids, would you rather they go to a really competitive school or a really collaborative school? And everyone says, well, we want a bit of competition, but really collaborative's better. Education is better in collaboration, isn't it? So I said, yeah, that's great. But what about you? Is that how you're going to treat this class? And you suddenly realize they're all sitting there waiting to be competitive with the other person, wondering if they're going to be shown up as the dumb one, which is just total madness. Mm. You know, if we let it go, we're all smart and we're all not smart in different ways. Understand that. And understand that learning is coming from not knowing very much to knowing a bit more.
Yeah.
Or having a beginning of a skill to a slightly better skill. And if you keep practice, it'll carry on. And if you're unmerciful with other people and stigmatizing people and making idiots of each other and you've been terrified of showing yourself up, you'll never chill and you'll never really be creative if you're chill, because if you're not chill, a little bit chilled, because your vision gets too narrow. And when you're more relaxed, you literally open up your peripheral vision, literally physically as well as, you know, internally in terms of your imagination. So I think you've got to create an environment that is neither too chill nor too hectic so that people are somehow in sync with the world they're working with. I don't know where that answer came from. That was a very long answer.
But I love
answer.
It. I
long
love
answer
it.
To a straightforward question. Yeah.
Because it actually leads in beautifully into cultural intelligence, right? Mm. Because I feel that cultural intelligence, you know, as the world is globalizing, you know, we have to manage diplomacy and geopolitics, and there's so many things that we need to navigate.
So going back to your question about culture, which is really interesting. I mean, if we could take our brains out and hold them in our hands, don't try this at home, okay? Because it's not good for you. You'd see that it's about the size of two fists, and they're fundamentally exactly the same. You know, it doesn't matter where you come from in the world, what gender you are, what race you are, whatever the concept of race means, you'll find that physically the brains are very similar. I mean, there's differences, no doubt, with various brains developing in different ways through particular skills or habits or practices. The neuroscientists will have to talk to that. I can't. But fundamentally, they're very similar. And culture is like the software of the brain. So what I like to think about the software of the brain is it's something that's learned and programmed. Probably programmed because in one part of the world or another, with a different climate or different way of living, different way of surviving, you've learned over time to develop particular beliefs and assumptions and ways of doing things, which no doubt changes the brain in some way, I imagine. But we also label that as culture. But culture is very relative. You know, there was a very interesting person called Claude Levi Strauss, who was an anthropologist, who talked about the idea of cultural relativism. You know, like if you're British and you're talking to French people, which is a classic difference, and we like brothers, but very different too, you might find that the French people would label all the British as being sort of shopkeepers. That was Napoleon's great one. Or sort of somehow untrustworthy or somehow not serious and flippant. And you might find the French as being rather arrogant or very likely to change their views. These are all kind of stereotypes. And all that happens is that somebody, you've got two cultures, two normal distributions, almost exactly the same, but slightly separated from each other. So it's slightly different. One person at one end of that cultural distribution looks at the person at the other end, one extreme, and labels the whole of the French people according to a few people who have a very different habit from your own. So all that stereotyping is looking at the differences of a small part of a population and labeling that for the whole population. And that is the source of all forms of racism and all the differences we see in culture. So we're trained to see the extreme differences rather than focusing on the things that bring us together where we're very, very similar. And I think a lot of talk about culture looks at it that way. When we really start to work with culture effectively, I think, is when you start to look at people in the eyes and see the common humanity in people. Mm. And I think that's the same for businesses as it is with nations, as it is in countries. And I think in business, when we start to talk about culture, we're trying to talk about culture as a way of doing things that helps the business model and helps people be engaged. And the difficulty with trying to manage culture is that whose culture is it? You know, who's defining what the culture is? It's often the CEO's culture or a dominant group's culture. You know, you're running your podcast of Conscious Lead Hers, which assumes that, and very correctly in many ways, that men have created an environment for women not to be able to be successful. So women are coming together to try and talk about that and reclaim and get power and opportunity, as it so rightfully should do. You know, at the same time, there's many men who wouldn't feel that way, want to be allies in men's movement. Mm. Hopefully, I'll be one of them. And so what happens is when you talk about culture too trivially, you kind of paint everyone the same color without seeing all the delicate nuances. It's like seeing one of those beautiful impressionist paintings or those pointiest paintings done with a million different colors that when you look up, you just see the differences. When you step back, you see the beautiful patterns. Mm. And so often we just paint a broad pattern without seeing what it's made up with. So I think when you're trying to work with culture, is you've got to just settle down a bit and be curious. And I think curiosity is one of the most important ways to deal with culture. There's three or four very good cultural researchers. One is Gert Hofstadter. Another one is Fons Trompenaars. There's Nancy Adler as well. And there was another person I used to work with called Jean-Claude Usinier, a French guy. And they all treat culture with very interesting kind of perceptions. Sure. For example, when you're doing business in Arabic countries, you might sit down and say, well, I'm going to have a cup of tea. Can we have a cup of tea? And you talk business would be very rude. So you have a cup of coffee, actually. And you'd have your cup of coffee and you drink it and, you know, and that would be it. You might not talk business. And so what was that about? And you come back again. You might do that for a year. And then eventually what happens, you might start opening for business. The American stereotype culture, you dive in and talk business. Right, let's get down to business. Let's have it. We're the lawyers. You get a contract set up. And what's curious about that is it's all about trust. The first culture is building trust through relationships and understanding the person. And when you build trust, you spiral inward to a point of trust and you do the business. Mm. And there's a lot of trust. And you don't perhaps need contracts in the same way because you're engaging and it's a personal engagement. But the stereotypical American one, you go straight to the heart of doing business and there's no trust. So you wrap it all around with lawyers. You know, you get very hard and it's very transactional. That it may be over the period of time when you've done business, you're spiraling outwards to get trust again. So there's these two very different ways of doing business. And you'll see that in South Africa a lot. You've got very different cultures in South Africa, very complex. Mm. And even within the many African cultures and tribal cultures you've got, and the different languages and perspectives, you'll find that there's great differences there, let alone between the obvious manifest ones with skin color and all the rest. And so the whole thing is about how do we find trust in culture? And very often when we're doing culture work in a company, it's because somebody has a business model, the CEO wants to make it work, understands that if you're doing complex, innovative work, you need people to be volunteer engagements. You can't force somebody to be creative. You can't force somebody to be passionate. It comes from inside them. So you create a culture where those things will emerge. Yeah. But it's awfully hard, and it can be very manipulative too if you don't watch out, because you'll find people ranting on about culture, and that culture will shift into being a cult, a cult, sure, rather than something positive. So you get a lot of companies, I think, where you have a cult-like engagement. And a lot of people will not want to be part of it because it, in a sense, closes down your critical faculties.
Mm.
And you become very clear that you have to think and believe in this very, very narrow area if you want to be part of that organization. And it works for the organization with people like that because you're trying to produce something. But my preference is for a culture that's far more critical, far more open, far more skeptical, if you like. There's a very famous phrase, which is from Descartes, I think, called cogito ergo sum, you know, I think, therefore I am. But actually, there was another word that starts. It's dubito, comma, cogito ergo sum. It means I doubt, therefore I think, therefore I am. And that's very interesting because actually you need to have the skepticism and doubt. So if you get a cult-type culture, you're destroying all skepticism. You're pushing out all people who might contradict it, and therefore you're not going to get a vibrant, critical piece of thinking. And I think that's what we have to do. We have to be quite mature about the way we deal with culture and not try to thrust it on people like a cult, because it'll work for a while, but you'll also damage people and yourself in the process, I believe.
Sorry,
that was a terribly long answer to a simple question.
Absolutely love it, and my brain is working overtime, and, you know, trying to process everything that you've said. But I think, you know, something that I always try and look at in the work that I do is I always go and look at the opposites in everything.
Yeah.
So the universe constitutes out of opposites. So if we look at, okay, fine, there's corporates and corporates working on cultural shifts and, you know, the cultural that's set within organizations and how we operate in the global, in the global world. But then if we look at our local cultures, now I personally, as a South African, I find sometimes I don't know enough about our cultures, and I wish I knew more, and wish there was more spaces that I can learn from all of the various cultures, because I feel like it's my country. I want to be able to indulge in all the various cultures and learn from them, because I think that there's so much wealth and richness in it. And I think that we've lost so much appreciation. We've lost the appreciation for cultures. And if you just look at AI now, so the languages, there's over 100 languages that is now being programmed and that AI is becoming fluent in. But there's over 7,000 languages in the world. And you know, we need to start looking at how do we start not losing for every new innovation, lose something old that could be very precious, that could teach us a thing or two. What's your view on that?
Well, I like to think quite simply about it. There are some, some languages there are words that don't translate, you know, or there are some languages where the idea of something is expressed in multiple variants of a word. You know, the classic one is Inuit languages about snow. You know, there's many qualities of snow that people who live in snow see, and people who rarely see snow have one word, which is snow.
Mm.
You know, and you could argue it's the same. The French will probably argue, and I used to live in France, so I love France, that the French have a massive vocabulary for love, and the British have one word. You know, now, again, this is cultural stereotyping and not true, and I'm at fault for doing that. But I think there are words and understandings that are developed in languages that are really important. And I think there are cultures that grow up around this language. I'm thinking of, you know, Welsh and Celtic, for example, where I come in the UK, that it's a shame that you lose those languages. Also, I think in some places there's deep, you know, quasi-scientific understandings. You might find people living in jungles in the Amazon or in Central Africa or whatever, who have such a deep knowledge of nature and the plants and such a rich vocabulary for them and understanding of them, they develop their own words, which are simply not translatable. So I think there are ideas like that. I think you'll find music is different. I think you'll find poetry is different. Dance is different. You know, some cultures are deeply scientific, but have a very different language for engaging with it. Like Chinese or Japanese languages for science are fairly impenetrable for people who've never understood them, yet are able to contain massive amounts of knowledge.
Yeah.
So I think it's almost impossible to imagine that a world with all those languages, which have grown up in little micro nodes in countries. For example, I think Ghana has over 100 languages. You know, we have 12 official languages, including sign language in South Africa. You can't really expect that all those languages will survive because people have to talk them. Mm. I mean, language is a medium of communication and transference of meaning and understanding. So when you're able to talk to masses of people like now through social media, you've probably only got a few languages you're going to be engaging that with because people are not going to learn all their little languages.
Mm.
What we don't want to do is lose nature. We might lose the way we describe life. We might use the way we, you know, describe nature, but we don't want to lose nature itself. And that's a common understanding. You know, so maybe some of these languages will help you understand part of nature, but what we have to come together is to understand we live in one world where we're all totally interdependent. You can't avoid the fact that somebody shoves something in the atmosphere halfway around the world, or if there's a nuclear blowout, that'll go all the way around the world. It's like a pandemic. We're all completely dependent on each other now, but we don't have the language properly, nor the governance systems, nor the communication systems, nor the software of the mind, if you like, the culture that's come to understand and manage that. And if we are going to manage this very complex world that we're affecting in such powerful ways now with more and more people, we're going to have to develop different ways, different narratives, if you like. And this is where I find that Yuval Noah Harari is quite interesting when he talks about his meta-narratives and meta-stories. How do millions of people come together? They come together through what he describes as a meta-narrative, a belief. It could be communism, capitalism. It could be a religious belief system. It could be a national belief, if you like, in a way you've got billions of people. But they come together around language and understanding of a story. But we haven't got a story that's really going to be able to manage the changes in the world we're facing yet. So taking that big picture and coming back down to South Africa and to our business, what do we have to do? Well, I think we have to understand that the narratives we create are really, really important, and that a narrative is a collective understanding. And if it's a dominant voice, it becomes a propaganda, doesn't it? And I think what we need to do is make sure that we have firm opinions that we express, but we hold our firm opinions quite lightly, strong opinions lightly held, rather than strong opinions held like I'm never going to move.
Oh my gosh, I forgot that quote of yours.
Yeah.
It's
such an important thing because
you
have your opinion, you know, but when somebody comes up with another opinion, you know, the orangutan, you know, these two are not the same. I might hold to this, but I'm clearly looking at something quite different that I've not conceived. So let go of your opinion a bit and allow yourself to learn about this new topic, and then you're going to have an orangutan-shaped water bottle in that, or whatever it is. But allow yourself to move and learn. Don't be so scared of ignorance that you can't move, because if you look at the sum total of our knowledge about the universe and just how unbelievably incomprehensibly vast it is, how can we know more than just a nano piece about it? We know so little. So, of course, there's more to learn. And even when you're talking to, you know, you're talking to a doctor, you're talking to an engineer, talking to human resources, to a musician, their depth of knowledge is enormous, but there's practically no way to even translate or conceive what those knowledge bases are between the individuals. So how can you know everything? It's just a ridiculous vanity. You know, just know your little bit, but be curious and get the joy from learning more and enriching and growing and changing and becoming more as you get on through life. How much more can I understand?
I love that you're talking about this. So I've always considered myself a polymath. So I like different disciplines and like to learn different things. I feel like if I have a more generalist approach, I can do more with it. Obviously, going deep is important sometimes. But, you know, I think this world is requiring of us, especially now with AI, the age of AI is all about us learning different things. But I think it is really the curiosity behind that. I mean, you stepped into a class with Dr. Puling where we were doing the Innovation Unleashed, and you spoke to us about, there was a gentleman that asked, he said he wants to do an MBA in finance. And you're like, what do you do for a living? And he said, I do finance. And you were like, but why do you want to do an MBA in finance? Do something different. And I think that is exactly as like we're becoming gatekeepers of our intelligence. Like we don't want to expand beyond something we don't know. And isn't that what it's all about, is trying to understand different views, different and becoming more knowledgeable on different subjects?
Yeah, I think from not having much knowledge about something to getting a lot of knowledge about something
is important.
Whatever that thing is, yeah, it's super important because then you're employable and useful in that area. But is that all there is, that you become that one thing? Because what are you clinging to? The idea of being a polymath is really interesting. You have to have quite a lot of knowledge about a lot of things. So I think we've got to understand, you've got to learn. You probably remember Ken Robinson, who did that very famous TED talk about education. He wrote a book called The Element. He was a Sir Ken Robinson. He was an educationist. If you haven't seen his TED talk, go and look at it. But one thing very interesting, he said that if you're in an orchestra, you know, you've got violinists, you've got the flute, you've got percussion, you've got, I don't know, all these different people in the orchestra. And it just, you know, some people love the violin and really clicked with it and became superb violinists. Some people loathe the violin, carried on doing it, never got anywhere. But if they picked up a flute or an electric guitar, they might have found the medium. And the idea was, find your medium. Find the one thing that you're going to excel in. And this is part of the hunt in life. Find the things that you really, that somehow with you, you click with and you're going to work with. Because there's always some use for that. There's always some employability in that. There's always some contribution as well. But struggling on in the place that you don't really fit, you can't really do, you might have to do that, you know, just because you want to be employable. But just imagine how much more you could be if you found that medium. And that's why you need curiosity and you need guts, because you don't have to let go of everything to move over here. Mm. You can still be employable and doing your finance, whatever it is, but you can be doing a lot more as well. And that's why these days it's kind of difficult to think of a career. There's a famous actress was once asked, you know, you've had such a fabulous career. And she said, darling, all I've had is a series of roles.
I love that.
And you know, and it's like you're moving from one role to another, but that the summation of all that is a form of a career. And when you talk to somebody like that, said, you've done so many different things. How does that? Well, I did them because I was curious and it felt right. And it felt like the next thing and I got inspired by it. So I did it. You have these careers that it's a good book called Squiggly Careers, you know, rather than straight line. Most careers are squiggly and up and down. Let it be like that, because you're going to find a lot more in yourself. And sometimes if you're stuck in something, how do you get on to the next thing? And sometimes it's very difficult to let go of what you're held on to because you desperately need that security, or you want to educate your kids or whatever it is. But don't think that's all there is for you. Mm. You know, because there is so much more. And as an educationist, we see every time there's a graduation, I see these people who are coming up on stage and there's people crying in the audience. And why? It's their grandparents, it's their great grandparents, it's their children, it's their parents, because they've been working for generations to see that person be able to get on stage.
Yeah.
And you realize just how much it means, this sort of achievement. And I think we really need to encourage that with people and make it much easier for people who are excluded by poverty and other things that we've created for them by the poor ideas we've had about what business should be and what society should be. We should come up with better ideas and get those people included, because their brains are the same. Mm. There's no reason why they should be there. Mm. None at all. It's cultural, it's habitual. If we are going to create a brilliant country, we need to get more and more people engaged. And if there's obstacles to women achieving, that's absolutely mad. How can it be that the incredible capacity and achievement and capability of this half of humanity? I mean, it's mad that we don't all have the opportunity. Mm. And if you're a man and you're challenged by that, well, that's fine. Be challenged by it. And also understand what masculine means and how you might be changing your perception of that. Mm. And over time, how we collectively understand what the different roles and the kind of contributions of men and women might be as they evolve at the same time.
Mm.
But that's getting philosophical. So
listen, that conversation gets me so excited. We actually unpacked in a recent networking event we had the role of women in leadership and just talking about our differences and how we show up differently. And I think we've learned so much about masculinity and femininity and bringing that into what we do. But, you know, it's been such a fascinating conversation with you, and I wish we could talk for a very long time. I want to tie this up, and I want us to perhaps just talk about, you know, from a culture intelligence perspective, everything that we do and every transaction that we do require this of us. What is the areas that we need to develop in order to improve our cultural intelligence? What curiosity, which should we explore, etc.?
Well, I don't think it's very complex or even difficult. I mean, we create this idea of cultural intelligence. It's a big abstract word. And, oh, how do I get to understand that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you stand next to somebody who's different from you in some way. And you can be shut down or scared by that difference, which is a pity because, you know, it means you don't feel easy to, or you can be strong enough in yourself and comfortable enough in your uncertainty in who you are and knowing that you don't have to be perfect, but you do have to learn. Just be curious. So be curious and be respectful. So what happens is we instantly make judgments about difference. Very typically, we make judgments all the time, or we make judgments about somebody because they're poor or because they're black, because they're white, whatever. We have all the thing is, all of us have this stuff in us. We're all conditioned when we're vulnerable, we're defenseless to think differently about people in different ways, because as much as a culture highlights some positive attributes, they often denigrate in some way or fear different cultures. So those dynamics come in. So just be curious and be respectful and see what you can learn. I mean, I'm a middle-class Brit who went to private schools. If you want to know a bit about that, I'm probably one of your go-to people. If I'm going to talk about women in South Africa and needing to change the dynamic there, you know, I'll have a few ideas on that, but I'm not your go-to person. You're my go-to person, or she's my go-to person. And in other words, you're my gift. You're my gift. I can only understand that perspective on life through you, because I never lived it. If I'm open to it, or I can listen and I can try and relate, I will get this rich understanding of what that means. You know, and even if it comes with disappointment or anger or whatever, I can understand that and I don't have to be affected by it. So you're my gift and these people are your gifts. So people who are different for you, different cultures, they're a gift to you. Understand what they've got and how it's different. When you start thinking like that, what happens is your brain becomes bigger and your perception of life and how people are becomes bigger. Your judgments diminish. And never think you can stop yourself judging, but you can't. But you can imagine a hook in the sky where you see the judgment and say, I see you and I'm going to hook you up there for a bit. I'm just going to suspend you for a while and just carry on as if you weren't there. I know I had that judgment and I'm sorry I had it in me, but it came up. I can't deny it. I might as well accept it. But I can probably move on from that by being curious and learning from you. So when I see your smile and who and what you are, you've obviously a lot of joy in your life. I'd love to learn a bit more about that. And I see you doing things different from me in that context. Wow, I can learn about that. I shouldn't believe that who I am, what I am, is some form of definition of good or great. Mm. It's just what I am, you know. And what we are collectively could be so much more. So let's have a go at that.
Oh, that is so beautiful. I absolutely love that. Oh, my word. It's a gift. It's a gift. Thank you, John, as always, for taking things that seem so complex and simplifying them, because cultural intelligence is a word that's been going around a lot, but I don't think that it's fully understood. And we sometimes, like I was watching this, this one woman, she was talking, she's been cooking her whole life and she's the cook of her family, and all this recipes that's come down from generation to generation that women have always cooked, and the industry of chefs that is so male dominated, yet women have always cooked. And why does it have to be so intellectualized when it is actually a simple act that has always been coming from a good place, from a good heart, and nurturing of the family, that has somehow lost its value. So yeah, it's really so important just to go back to the basics and really understand the wisdom and the curiosity and bringing it into every fabric of your life and tie those threads together. I love that. Thank you.
Pleasure.
All right. To our audience, thank you so much for joining in, and follow the link below. Go and check out Henley Business School. They've got amazing programs to follow, and it was such an honor to bring this amazing guest to you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.